draw for the community.
Well, let me ask you this. Let's suppose that there indeed was a market, it was a draw, but it involved, I don't know, doubling the traffic in the neighborhoods or increasing it by 50%. Should the neighborhoods have a say in whether this should happen or not?
Well, they should have a say, but also if we're going to have, as we do have and should have, private property, then the private property owners should also have a say. Okay, these things have to cut both ways. My sense of it from where I sit right now is that I think that, number one, the master plan, everything inside the master plan will be up for grabs when it is reanalyzed.
When will that be?
Before anything specifically is established, before anything specific is instituted. Now, my thinking is that the Third Street realignment, which probably should have happened 20 years ago, is long overdue. My thinking is that I don't see any particular problem with a bridge over the San Lorenzo from Ocean Street connecting a new realigned Third Street to bring tourists into the flats who want to go to the boardwalk and the wharf. I don't see why that's such a dastardly thing.
Well, now, of course, that's a whole additional debate, but in fact, that's not what's on the City Council agenda, right? They are not proposing a bridge. In fact, conservative Steve Hartman, who was on the air with me 2 weeks ago, stated that he was kind of annoyed with the whole plan because it didn't provide this extra bridge, and that because it didn't, it was sort of kind of bogus.
Well, I think that the reasoning, it's not stated, but I believe the reasoning behind a realignment of Third Street is ultimately to put a bridge across the San Lorenzo.
So they're kind of
Ocean Street.
They're kind of using the head in the tent or the tail in the tent or the foot in the tent approach.
I don't necessarily see that as being bad. I think it ought to be brought more above board.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I think, like I said, to me, a lot of these issues, they cut both ways. I can understand those that live in the neighborhood being uncomfortable with change. However, I do not understand, and I know this might sound uncomfortable, but migrant shack preservationism in the name of housing.
So you didn't really, have you ever taken the tour that Jane Bear has of the houses that are going to be torn down?
No, I have not. I'm reasonably familiar with the area.
Because I did, actually. That's you hear me kind of interrupting her too much, by the way, because she had more to say than I did, and I should have given her more airtime there. She showed me house after house that was actually looked perfectly good shape, that was going to be torn down, and you know, irrespective of the wishes of the people who live there. And again, it seems, and again, this is what I hear from person after person, that other than the City Council and their staff, that there's no guarantees for affordable housing at all for the people who are going to be dumped from the beach flats.
Well,
that concerns me.
Because we have gone down this road of subsidized housing, there probably should be a significant fraction of that guaranteed other subsidized housing. However, change does happen. Eminent domain is not in and of itself a bad thing. Freeways are built by eminent domain. Property owners are generally compensated above.
But is it a good deal for the city? I mean, is giving, you know, $3.5 million to Canfield for the Third Street realignment a good investment?
It's not necessarily giving it to Canfield. I mean, certainly the Seaside Company is going to benefit. And to give Scott Kennedy some credit in his op-ed piece, the city does get 5% of the admission take.
Mm-hmm.
From the Canfield operation. There's a lot of tourist interest in that area, the wharf, the boardwalk, Beach Street.
You know, I got a feeling that your call is going to heat up the phone lines, Bob.
Oh, thank you very much. Last thing I'd like to say is that I think increased density, built-in backyards is the way to go. And I would look at the east side.
Thank you, Bob.
Thank you very much.
Well, I asked for proponents of the beach flats plan to call in, and there's our first caller. Let's see what that provokes on the line.
Hi, you're on Free Radio Santa Cruz.
Hi, this is your producer, Becky Johnson.
Hi, yes.
I just want to respond to a few things that Bob said. The Third Street realignment without the bridge at Ocean Street means that the only purpose of putting it in is to expand the boardwalk. And indeed, Canfield needs that particular acreage to expand his boardwalk. Secondly, Bob Bob was talking about what kind of significant income that we get from the Seaside Company. The tax on that 5% amounts to $1,350,000 a year, which I think is a drop in the bucket. I mean, the city budget is Santa Cruz, is the general budget's about $200 million. Seems small potatoes. We get very little in terms of property taxes from the boardwalk because it was purchased so long ago, and because of the provisions under Proposition 13, the way it's assessed is at the last purchase price, and that was many, many years ago.
Now, is this 5% tax a property tax, or is it some other kind of tax?
No, it is not a property tax. Mm-hmm. That 5% is taken off the top for all ride tickets that are sold.
Well, so wouldn't it be that if the boardwalk expands, this tax will give more revenues to the city?
Theoretically, mm-hmm. Yes. But if that's such an important concern, how come the same city council about a year ago voted to take off the tax they had in place on all the arcade games, which amounted to a $100,000 loss to the city in revenue?
That's even less of a sum, so even more of a drop in the bucket, right?
I think if people saw the actual numbers, and this is for 3.2 million visitors a year, with 3.2 million visitors worth of traffic and garbage and policing concerns and air pollution and noise that all the residents in Santa Cruz have to put up with. And if we're doing all of this, and we do hear that the Canfield Company is the 14th most profitable amusement park in 1997, that Canfield's making an awful lot of money off of this, and the city is only getting a pittance at this point in time.
Mm-hmm.
I'd like to hear what other people have to say.
Sure. Thank you, caller.
Our topic for today on Bathrob Spear's Broadside, Civil Rights for the Poor, at the moment anyway, is the planned destruction of housing in the beach area, compliments of Charlie Canfield and the Canfield Council, the Kennedy-Rotkin crew that is serving the boardwalk up for dinner to Charlie. You're listening to Bathrob Spear, Robert Norse on the air, talking about the issue, and actually for the first time, compliments of some brave callers getting the other point of view, which I'm always glad to hear, because I think it's important that this be a debate and not a monologue, either on this side or on the other side. I want to point out that today is Keith Sugar's kickoff at from 3 to 5, and I'm going to learn from my producer shortly whether, in fact, Keith wants this announced in terms of the address at which the kickoff is. Well, different things are happening that I wanted to bring to your attention. A new Street Shit Sheet, which is the homeless publication that I used to put out quite regularly and haven't done too much of recently, turning my attention instead to flyers and trying to fight getting evicted from meetings on the whims of certain leaders, is coming out tomorrow or the next day. It's got lots of interesting stuff, but particularly interesting to me is the attack on Feed the People and Sean Alini, a guy I call Shit Kicker Sean because of his willingness to stand up to censorious, exclusivist kind of practices by the merchants who want to run him and his peanut butter and jelly giveaway out of town. This may sound kind of trivial to some folks, but to those who are hungry, on Mondays and Tuesdays at 5:30, and happen to be in front of the Logos book area on downtown Pacific, it's not trivial at all. If you're hungry, you eat those sandwiches, and I've seen dozens of those sandwiches go real fast, not just to people who are walking around in rags either, or people who are passing through town in tie-dyes. I'm talking about people who live here. They're hungry. Times are not the best, no matter what the papers tell you. And I think that the idea of an exclusivist policy driving people who help homeless people away from the downtown area as the apparently merchants are now attempting to do with Sean Alini is the worst of policies, and it will produce a kind of backlash and reaction and hopefully resistance that we've seen before. We saw it in the soup wars, the swap wars, soup without a permit, which served hot soup at the town clock in 1988 and 89, when then-Mayor Marty Wormhout adopted the ill-conceived policy of arresting food servers, Jane Immler, Linda Edwards, myself, Malou Pinecrone, Ray Glock Grunike, Joe Schultz of India Joe's, and dozens of others for simply trying to get hot food out to homeless people at the town clock. Now, we thought we were in more enlightened times, but as you're going to learn reading the new Street Chit Sheet, there is an attack against Sean Alini, which involves the health department, officers Eveleth and Over ticketing his vehicle, a projected injunction by Logos Books, and just a general policy of harassment, which sounds suspiciously familiar and just petty, mean, low, and completely unnecessary in a civilized, tolerant community. But as I said, sometimes the best people seem to get into the worst frames of mind, and the most civilized people start following policies that are barbaric, to be generous, and they start getting exclusive with different groups of people. You see it at the city council level, where people like Scott Kennedy and Mike Rotkin are trying to completely muffle the debate on this issue and rush the beach boardwalk plan. And we see it at other levels where leaders who are respected and followed are then demanding a standard of loyalty from their followers that involves excluding from their meetings those that they don't agree with or that they don't like. We have to be in a position where we are all big enough to work with each other. We have to be in a position where we are advocating policies of inclusiveness, which are the opposite of those of the city council. In fact, those are the ones that the city council was elected on, because progressives thought that's what Kennedy and Rotkin and Matthews and Hernandez were all about. That's why SCAN endorsed some of those candidates. That's why people put in work to put them in place. Because they were not going to muzzle debate at the mic. They were not going to rush through secret plans. They were not going to get together with developers beforehand and pay hundreds of thousands, if not millions of dollars, in isolation from the community and community input. They were not going to shut off debate when people came to talk about these things. They were not going to close their meetings and make decisions in closed session. We, who are fighting this, must not adopt those tactics. We must not have meetings where one person's decision, the leader in the group who decides suddenly that he doesn't like what someone else did 3 or 4 years ago, then doesn't want to talk about it, but instead will simply evict that person, as happened, by the way, last night. That kind of thing can't happen. That kind of thing we've got to get bigger than this. We've got to grow bigger than this. We've got to be a real alternative to the kinds of policies that are happening at City Hall now. And we can be, and we will be. I think this community is strong enough to do that, and I'm hoping that we are going to do that, and I'm hoping that this kind of dialogue that we're having on the radio and throughout the community, and hopefully in Spanish as well as English on October 1st, this kind of dialogue is going to continue at City Hall, even if the masters of City Hall, I should say the kidnappers of City Hall, because these people aren't the masters, they have the power at the moment, but the real power comes from us, the people here. We are the real caretakers of City Hall. We are the people that those buildings are supposed to serve, that government is supposed to serve. Not Canfield and the Seaside Company, not a small band of merchants downtown, not a bunch of out-of-town developers and the people that they've persuaded on the city council. No. The broader community are the people that are supposed to be served here. And when we find our voice, our voices, and we are finding our voices, these people will run for cover. And hopefully that's what's happening, is what's going to happen, as I said, on October 1st at City Hall. And I want to encourage you to give a call in to support this effort of the group to save the beach. And you heard from Roxanne earlier talking about that. I'm scurrying to find that her phone number again, so I can actually give you the proper number. What I'll give you at the moment is a second number I've been given. That's that of the person we're about to hear from, Phil Baer. His number is 423-0170. If you want to help this effort, you can contact him. We have an incoming call.
Hi, you're on Free Radio Santa Cruz.
And Friends of the Beach, Roxanne Acustapache, can be reached at 426-3026.
426-3026. Thank you.
Well, now let's hear from Uncle Phil Baer and what he has to say about events in the last week at City Hall, actually at the Civic Auditorium, because we were finally able to pressure the City Council to get that thing moved to a venue, to a buildings where people could actually cram in. Of course, then they cut off the time to speak, and we'll be talking about that as well. But let's hear Phil's take on all this.
We have on the line with us a Phil Baer, community activist from the Beach Flats. Hi, Phil.
Hey, Robert.
And it looks like Scott Kennedy is getting back page coverage on the community forum, Progressives Love to Hate the Seaside Company. Actually, progressives love to hate Scott Kennedy these days, but
yes.
What do you make of this article?
Oh, God, man. You can guess my reaction. I find it just ironic to the point of farcical.
What's ironic? I mean, Scott is saying that...
Progressives don't love to hate the Seaside Company. There is absolutely no pattern of ongoing attempt to undo or close down the Seaside Company. We accept the boardwalk as it is. This isn't about accepting or rejecting or liking or disliking the boardwalk as it is. It is about a mammoth proposal to exponentially enlarge the boardwalk. And we say, okay, the boardwalk is cool as it exists. We can live with it. We've lived with it for decades. It's fine, but enough is enough. There's a difference between accepting the status quo, which we do, and accepting incessant precedent-setting enlargements that threaten to just overwhelm the beach area, if not the whole downtown.
Well, now there's a claim here. A real eye-opener for me was the collapse of a proposed 60-unit affordable housing project on land owned by Seaside. Canfield cooperated with the city, but two progressive council members refused to use eminent domain authority to take two decrepit houses, which have since been red-tagged and slated for demolition. What is Kennedy talking about here?
He must be referring to a project that was called the Vista del Rio. It was about 12 years ago, I believe, and it was a Seaside Company project that they were arranging with the Community Housing Corporation, which was at the time the city's designated developer of affordable housing, as it was termed. As I understand, what really happened there is Seaside Company at that time wanted to use the area on which sat the old Casa del Rey over there along Beach Street. They had another plan for that area. They wanted to get those old folks out of there, but did not want to have to deal with the expense of relocating them. So they had cooked up an arrangement with the Community Housing Corporation and to some degree with the city that would allow them to provide a piece of land on which the city would build a big, high-density, affordable housing project, and that would satisfy their obligations to relocate those people. That was the plan. Then what happened? The earthquake hit, and the Casadel, all those people had to move because it was claimed that the building had suffered significant damage in the earthquake. I might point out that nobody ever observed any such damage, and that there is the allegation that the Seaside Company simply used the earthquake as a pretext for getting rid of all of those people. If you have to get rid of renters because of a natural disaster, you have no obligation to provide them with replacement housing. So he used, the allegation would have it, he used the earthquake to get out from under the obligation to relocate those people.
Now wait a minute, Ann Parker, his PR chief, assured me at a, I guess it was a planning commission meeting or a city council meeting, I think it was a planning commission meeting this summer, that Charlie had nothing but caring and concern for the old folks in the, what's it called, the Vista Del Rio project?
Casa Del Rey.
Casa Del Rey, sorry about that. Casa Del Rey project. In fact, went down with the earth, after the earthquake, with blankets to help out those folks. Are you saying that he gave them blankets and then he gave them the boot?
As I understand, those people just had to leave. Some of them managed to arrange other accommodations for themselves. Others did not fare so well, but he did, in fact, avoid what would have otherwise been the rather sizable financial obligation to actually provide them with housing elsewhere, because it was a natural disaster rather than a mere whim of his business desires that caused those folks to have to move. And the way that impacts the tentative project that was planned, the Vista Del Rio affordable housing project, is because he no longer had to relocate those people, had that obligation, because the earthquake, the way he used the earthquake, he no longer had to cooperate with the city on the Vista Del Rio and provide them with the land, and perhaps he was actually going to provide some additional financial backing, I don't know, but he was at least going to provide them with the land. He no longer had to do that because he'd taken care of his old folks in the Casa Del Rey, so therefore that project fell through. That's why the project fell through. It did not fall through because two former council members refused to use eminent domain to take two houses. I don't know how that would have stopped it anyway. Two council members are not a majority, and I never even heard of that part of it.
Yeah,
it fell through because Panfield no longer had the motivation to provide the land that was necessary to build the thing on.
Well, you know, it seems to me, you know, when one reads this story, one thinks, of course, of the two council members who are closely questioning the consultants and asking that there be adequate time for this plan, council members Scott and Byers.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sorry, Byers. Yeah, it is Scott and Byers. But you're talking about something that happened before either Byers or Scott were on the council.
Yes, it would not be them. That statement was also erroneous. Kennedy's statement also erroneous in that those buildings, to my understanding, are not red tagged and are not slated for demolition.
Could he be speaking of something else?
No.
You don't think so?
No.
So you think that in fact he was talking about, again, the name of the project was the
Vista Del Rio.
Vista Del Rio. And so he's talking about the Vista Del Rio.
He must be. There's simply no other place that he could be talking about.
Now, what do you say when, in looking further in his article, the Seaside Company is one of the city's biggest employers, hiring more than 600 people at peak season. The city's 5% emissions tax on all rides at the boardwalk makes the company one of the two largest contributors to the city's tax base and revenue. Well, shouldn't we be concerned then about their economic health and well-being?
No. They are the 14th most profitable theme or amusement park in the entire country.
According to?
The New York Times showed those statistics about 2 months ago.
So
I think the top 20. The top 20 in the country, and there was the Seaside Company at number 14.
So you're suggesting that concerns at the Civic Auditorium City Council meeting last week that the Seaside Company was in economic trouble are not accurate?
Oh, on the contrary. They're rolling in the bread. That's why they want to expand. They got a lot of capital with which to do it.
But what about this claim that the Seaside Company gives the city coffers a 5% of boardwalk ticket sales before expenses, repayment of loans or investments. Imagine if, in addition to the normal taxes and fees, Scotts Valley took 5% off the top of Borland Enterprises income, or Watsonville got 5% of Seagate's or Driscoll's sales. So aren't we doing a lot better than those two cities?
I don't know about Scotts Valley. I don't know. I'm sure they get a little something out of Borland. What I do know is that the city, we finally managed to extract from the city an estimate on what the proposed expansion would generate to the city in terms of increased tax revenue. And the first phase of the expansion, after 4 years, that is to say when it was fully chugaling, was estimated to generate $88,000 per year in additional revenue to the city. The Third Street realignment, which would be required in order for them to put in that first phase expansion, would be an expense that they have already identified of being at least in the $3 million range, presumably a publicly borne expense. So to recover that $3 million at $88,000 a year would be, what, 30 or 40 years before they even recover their investment. So in terms of financial benefit to city government, which of course is quite a different matter than financial benefit to the people of this city and the impact on the environment of this city and the quality of life of this city, just purely in terms of Scott being able to balance his budget at City Hall, it does not seem to be a moneymaker. In fact, it seems to be an enormous fiscal drain on the city.
Well, I noticed that only one page of the massive report, which was available for the public at the public hearings on Tuesday and Thursday last week, goes into fiscal impact.
There's no cost-benefit analysis. That's been a consistent request from the public. How can we approve of a plan like this when we have no idea how much it's going to cost or how much it's going to benefit us? All those figures are totally fuzzy.
Indeed.
It's like signing a blank check.
I myself have not heard from the partisans, and there were, I guess, the largest number of people in favor I've ever seen. Most of them are seemingly mobilized by the Seaside Company at the last few hearings. Nobody really went into the specifics that I remembered. I didn't hear every bit of testimony, but do you recall hearing any particular partisan talk about the particular financial benefits to be derived?
No.
Because I don't recall that coming up.
No.
And again, as I said, I wasn't there every minute of the time, and my attention was often distracted, but I continue to await in the media or from the proponents of this plan a very specific cost-benefit analysis, which would lead us to say, hey, well, it may be a real drain on the traffic, it may kill those seals, it may dislocate the Hispanics in the neighborhood, but by goodness, it provides a lot of money for the city in the following specific ways. And yet, there doesn't seem to be anything like that forthcoming.
No, nothing. Not even the amount that the city supposedly benefits now. You'll notice Kennedy's phrasing is not dollar figures. It's suggestions that it's significant, but it's not dollar figures. I'd like to see some concrete numbers.
Mm-hmm. What about this idea of the fact that the beach flats has remained neglected for the last 20 years? What's your analysis? First of all, is that an accurate assessment?
No.
And second of all, if it is, I guess you're denying it is, but who's responsible for that?
Well, the underlying cause of all beach flats problems, what conceivable other cause, why else would you have this piece of land a block away from the finest beach in Northern California, some of the best weather in the world, right here? Why would an area with those characteristics have the problems associated with the beach flats? What other conceivable explanation could there be for an underlying cause of those problems if not the area's proximity to the boardwalk and the fact that many people just don't want to live next to that kind of an operation? The there is no other possible explanation.
Playing the devil's advocate, the city council members who are favoring this, specifically Rapkin and Kennedy, would probably or might respond, well, absentee landlords who have let their properties run down are to blame for failing to keep the standard of life up in the beach flats.
Yes, but that is not getting down to the root cause. Why are there absentee landlords rather than resident owners? It's because the absentee landlords don't want to live down here. So they buy it because they've got the money to buy it. They don't want to live down here, so they buy it, hopefully, as a moneymaker, which it is for some, but not for others. But the reason why it's absentee landlords rather than resident owners is because the people with the money don't want to live down here.
Another thing Kennedy says is Seaside was buying many properties and demolishing quite a few. I saw that the company generally removed units which were unsalvageable and upgraded decent units. I learned that Seaside does a far better job managing properties in beach flats than most property owners. What's your take on that?
The impact of the boardwalk on housing in the beach flats has been to eliminate it. Their history, and I could point out lots of specific unit housing. They were bought in perfectly fine condition, including some stuff that they shouldn't have been able to tear down because it was historically significant, fine old houses from the very first years of European settlement in this city. Historically significant stuff made out of that solid old heart redwood that would last forever if you just left it alone. Got it, emptied it out, cleared out the people living in it, let it sit there for 2 years to avoid the demolition ordinance, and then came in frequently in the middle of the night practically with chainsaws and tore it all down before anybody was able to get in touch with the city because the city offices weren't even open yet to find out if they had the permits to demolish it or not.
What was this property and when did this happen?
The very parcel on which they then wanted to do the Vista del Rio. When they bought it, something in the neighborhood of maybe, I don't know, 13, 14 years ago, had three houses on it, all of them fine, one of them exceptional, just really a fine pre-Victorian example of the earliest European settlement of this city in excellent condition, just a gorgeous house. It was like a historical museum unto itself. Nothing wrong with it structurally or in any other way. Residents, perfectly fine people, no crime, no substandard conditions, no nothing. They just cleared it out. That's what they do again and again. They're not in the housing business. They buy housing in order to clear the housing off and eventually convert it to commercial. Half, more than half, of the area that they're talking about down there by the 3rd Street realignment, all those areas that are grassed over that appear to be commercial parking area are in fact composed of individual family residential parcels that they picked up over the years and knocked down the fences, knocked down the houses, and given it this seasonal parking quasi-commercial function. But in fact, all of that is what remains of what was a residential neighborhood, a very solid, fine residential neighborhood, until Seaside picked it up piece by piece and tore the housing out. Seaside doesn't build housing, it destroys housing.
Now, what kind of alternative plan, I know you've heard this one before, what kind of alternative would you see for a renaissance in the beach flats that would remove those houses that are blighted, or let's say those apartments that are overcrowded, or let's say renovate them, and also act to make sure that those open spaces are put to some productive use? What kind of an alternate plan? Could eminent domain be turned around and go after the Seaside company that's purchased some of that property and return it to community use?
Well, that's an intriguing idea that a number of people are finding at least amusing. Certainly lots that are now zoned for residential, particularly many of those lots not even owned by the Seaside company, owned by other people willing to build housing on it if the circumstances enable them to do so, those residential parcels could provide the location for a whole bunch of affordable housing that we desperately need.
What kind of changes in the beach area south of Laurel plan would facilitate this different approach?
Well, these are private owners who own parcels which are zoned residentially. If the city made it clear that it wanted housing rather than more amusement parks, some housing would be built with or without any additional public assistance. With other situations, these resources that they're going to bring to bear, this encouragement, supposedly, from the redevelopment agency, the money that they have set aside for housing, the money available to organizations like Mercy Housing Charities, the money available and the work power available to groups like Habitat for Humanity, those things could all be utilized to build housing down there.
What else could be done with the beach flats in terms of providing more resources for the community down there, and that should be done, that you would like to be done if, let's say, a new city council is elected that stops this beach flats giveaway and turns things in a different direction?
Okay, well, that's Phil Baer talking to me earlier this morning about beach flats, and on the line with us, interrupting this very good interview, and we're going to go back to Phil in just a moment, is another man who's interested in the beach flats sufficiently so that he's actually complicating his newborn child's life and his family's life by running for city council and kicking off his council campaign today. Keith Sugar. Hi, Keith.
Hey. How you doing, Robert?
I'm good. You were looking pretty antsy at the city council meeting last week. Were you feeling frustrated there?
I was very well behaved, as was the audience, which I thought was very heartening, considering the bum rap that we came very close to getting from the city council in terms of being able to present public input.
Yeah, I think the audience is perennially too well behaved, and we allow the council's misbehavior to run rampant over the town. That's my concern, of course.
Well, there's no need to just because they're not behaving themselves, there's no need for us to go to that level. But the thing that really galled me about the meeting was the very proactive and aggressive approach that Kennedy, Rotkin, and Matthews were taking to stymieing and silencing public comment.
Can you be specific about that?
Public opposition. Well, I'll tell you this. You know, those council members easily took up about an hour of time at the meeting proclaiming how there was not sufficient time to hear the public.
Right.
But they did see fit to chew up an hour of time talking about whether or not to hear the public. So clearly it was a pretext for just cutting off any debate, shortening the deliberation process. And it's clear to me that the reason that they wanted to do that is because the more time that elapses between now and final project approval, the more the opposition to this project grows. And seeing that, they are trying to usher this thing through as quickly as possible before opposition builds to such a degree that it becomes politically undoable.
I'm going to ask you the $64,000 question that I asked you before and that I've been really trying to get some clear answers to and have not been able to get a really finally definitive answer to, and that is simply, what if they pass this plan on the 6th? Well, when they pass this plan on the 6th, whether with their 5-2 majority, what can they do between now and the election that will result in anything that the next council, assuming that we get 3 new candidates who oppose the plan, cannot change?
Again, you know, and this is a definitive answer, to the degree that there are any project-specific approvals with this project, there is very little chance that we would be able to undo that either through a referendum or through subsequent action by the city council. For instance, part of this project includes certain parking structures. Okay, it's not in concept. I believe that it actually includes the parking structures themselves. Once those things go through, it's a done deal. Okay, and
don't they require separate city council approval?
It would require separate city council approval to basically rubber stamp it. See, here's why you've been looking for a concrete answer and why the water is seemingly so muddy. They keep saying that everything that they build under the rubric of this master plan, if you will, is going to require separate approval, separate environmental analysis, separate input from the public. That's really a sham. This is what we call a specific plan. And when you have a specific plan, all of the elements that are discussed in the specific plan are basically approved at this point. Okay? All that's going to be left over to squabble about later, when we start talking about specific projects like the roller coaster or an outlet center, that kind of thing, all that's going to be left to squabble about at that point is the sufficiency of a negative declaration or, design review and that sort of thing. But the city, if it does not overturn this specific plan once it gets approved, is really going to be locked in to allowing all the projects and all the growth that this plan envisions.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the city council repeatedly says that's not the case, but I'll tell you that as a land use / environmental attorney that deals with these sorts of issues all the time, that's not the case.
So you're saying that even though a formal vote might be required on parts of the plan, it would be difficult for the council, you're saying politically difficult or legally difficult for the council to reverse this plan piecemeal?
Oh, if the new council is made up of Sugar Fitzmaurice and Crone, I don't think it will be politically difficult at all. The problem is it will be legally virtually impossible.
And on what basis, on what vested rights would have been granted, or temporary maps, as I've been suggesting?
Well, again, it wouldn't be vested until the city entered into some sort of development agreements with specific developers.
Mm-hmm.
The most that the subsequent city council can do would be to overturn the zoning and general plan changes that would go into effect as a result of the imminent approval on October 6th.
Mm-hmm.
That's what we can do. That's what is politically very doable if the three of us get on. What I'm worried about are the parts of this plan that would be vested, and I really can't give you an accurate picture right now as to...
City attorney claims none of them would be vested. Do you feel his analysis is inaccurate? Or?
I certainly hope it's not inaccurate. I really hope it's not inaccurate. If there are no vested rights at that point, then hopefully the subsequent city council will be able to undo the damage that this city council might do in approving the plan.
Mm-hmm. Well, you're going to be running a hard race in the next month.
I am running a hard race.
How's it looking?
This is a campaign. This is a campaign kickoff in name only. We've been walking the streets and attending forums and speaking to members of the community for a good month and a half now.
What do you find? Do you find yourself, is it pretty much laid down along the lines of yes on the Beach Flats plan, no on the Beach Flats plan?
You know what, I really honestly don't know anyone who's adopted that sort of a polarized attitude. The three progressive candidates believe, and so do most of the people that have been working on this thing, That some sort of revitalization is in order down to the beach area. Is this the right plan? I seriously doubt it and cannot support it. If for no other reason than the fact that we don't know what kind of social impact this plan is going to have, we don't know what kind of a fiscal impact it's going to have, and we don't know what kind of an environmental impact it's going to have. And that is because all of that information has been hidden from us by the city council, or simply not.
What are you going to do? What are you going to do when you're on the council next term? Hopefully, that will make sure that you and the new majority don't act in the same fashion that the old majority did. How can we be assured that you, on your pet issues, are not going to hide the same kind of stuff that the current council does? In other words, what new procedural changes do you have in mind that will open up the council processes to the public?
A very, very good question, and something that's dear to my heart. Open meetings, for one thing. You know, there's a thing called the Brown Act, which I'm sure you're familiar with. The Brown Act is a law that was passed back in the 50s because what was happening was municipalities were becoming very corrupt and very secretive in the way that they dealt with issues affecting the entire community is because there was no law that said that public decision-making had to be made in the open and in public. Then in, I believe it was 1958, the legislature passed the Brown Act, otherwise known as the Open Meetings Laws, which said that you had to conduct all legislative and quasi-judicial processes in public, whether you're a city council, a board of supervisors, or the state, or what have you,
mm-hmm.
special districts, etc. There are certain exceptions under the Brown Act that allow these decision-making bodies to make their decision-making in private. But these are exceptions only. They're to be only used in very, very rare and exceptional cases.
Litigation and personnel, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Mm-hmm.
But what the city council has done is they've scheduled regular closed sessions, which basically implies that it's not happening simply on an as needed exceptional basis, but rather it's happening all the time.
Are you talking about the litigation sessions that occur every 2 weeks in the afternoon, or are you talking about additional sessions?
Additional sessions.
Really?
Yeah. For instance, much of the decision-making that went behind the city's deal with the Seaside Company to dispose of the riverfront land there was made in behind closed doors. And I don't believe that that is appropriate. I don't believe that the biweekly closed sessions regularly scheduled are appropriate. As a council member, I would only support closed meetings on a bare minimum, absolute basis.
So you would be overthrowing a grand old tradition of the closed litigation session in the afternoon every 2 weeks that they have?
I would.
Do you know, is there support from the other two candidates who are running with you for this position?
I think there probably is, because it's of great concern to all of us.
Mm-hmm.
And again, if it's litigation where it is necessary to maintain secrecy in order to protect the best interest,